welcome to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week, we continue our celebration of Women's History Month by setting the record straight on a woman surrounded by mystery, myth, and legend, Pocahontas. Our guest will be Camilla Townsend, the author of a new biography of the Native American icon. Following that, Kelly Schrum will tell us about a site where we can learn about an episode in the history of Native Americans, the 1704 raid on Deerfield, Massachusetts. And Nancy Unger will change the subject, offering us some historical perspective on an item in the news, the guilty plea of lobbyist Jack Abramoff. But before we get to any of those segments, as we do each week, let's look at some items of historical interest in the news you may have missed, both of which are related to the subject of our interview. In 1957, archaeologists determined that the remains of the historic fort at Jamestown, Virginia, no longer existed, that it probably had been washed into the James River. A young graduate student at the time, William Kelso, wasn't convinced, and some three decades later, Kelso, by then a credentialed archaeologist in his own right, returned to the site and discovered the fort's remains. Since then, he and his team of archaeologists have gone on to find some 700,000 17th century artifacts. One of those discoveries is the skeleton believed to be one of the colony's founders, Bartholomew Gosnold, although the identity could not be proved through DNA tests and awaits confirmation. Another, one of Kelso's favorites, is a signet ring bearing the family crest of William Strachey, a friend of William Shakespeare, who arrived in 1610 after his ship wrecked in a hurricane on an island off the coast of Virginia. Some scholars believe that Strachey's written description of that wreck inspired Shakespeare's The Tempest. Today, as Virginia prepares to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the settlement, Kelso is chief archaeologist of the site. He was also one of the experts consulted during the making of the recently released film, The New World, the $30 million Hollywood epic telling the story, or at least a story, of Pocahontas. And speaking of The New World and William Strachey, according to an article in the National Geographic News, Blair Rudes, a linguist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, used a list of about 500 words of Virginia Algonquin compiled by William Strachey, as well as another 50 by John Smith, to recreate that native language, which is used extensively in the movie, even though the language has not been spoken for about 200 years. Which is a good point at which to turn to our interview for the week, which, not coincidentally, is with the author of a new biography on the Indian princess Pocahontas. This is Talking History. The public fascination with Pocahontas seems boundless. Over the centuries, she's inspired so many poems, books, and films that one reviewer of our guest's book admitted thinking at the start that he could not imagine that there was anything new to say about her. He changed his mind, concluding that Camilla Townsend's book abounds with fresh insights. Indeed, she reminds us that Pocahontas has become an icon in American history, but that before she became an icon, she was a real woman. She was a child who walked and played beneath the towering trees of the Virginia woods, and then an adult woman who learned to love and to hate Englishmen. Camilla Townsend is professor of history at Colgate University. Welcome, Camilla.
Hello.
You titled your book Pocahontas and the Powhatan Dilemma. This suggests that the book is about more than the life of Pocahontas. In brief, what was Powhatan's dilemma? Powhatan being Pocahontas' father, of course.
Yes, Powhatan was Pocahontas' father. She was a real woman, and he was a real man. He was the paramount chief of the Powhatan Indians, and the sources in the 17th century have made it clear, historians have known this for years, that he was a very shrewd man, quite an extraordinary diplomat. That hasn't, of course, come through to people in, shall we say, in the wider world. In pop culture, he's often viewed as something of a Neanderthal who didn't understand his daughter. And I think in an effort to save him from that reputation, historians recently have often commented on his sense of security, his power relative to the English. That is, they were dependent on him, of course, for food, even to know where they were going just at first. And they do a sort of a freeze frame, if you will, and don't press the matter forward into time. And of course, we all know that eventually the Indians, including the Powhatans, were decimated. I would argue then that he knew that he faced the dilemma of the greater power of the English, that he recognized quite early on that part of his shrewdness, part of his strength, was his ability to see the problem that they had and that the English were so much stronger. And his daughter, I would argue, worked with him in facing this dilemma and trying to deal with it.
Why were the English so much stronger? There were fewer of them.
Yes, there were fewer of them. And again, because the English were so dependent on the Indians at first for food and for knowing where they were even, we have had a tendency in the field in recent times to argue that the English weren't so much stronger. But of course, they were. They had technology on their side. I think, in fact, in recent times we have been afraid to say that the English had superior technology. I think there's been a fear, if you will, of acknowledging that because it would be easy for people to press the matter further and say, well, then the English must have been superior in terms of their intelligence, perhaps even in terms of their moral worth. And in fact, as you know, in the Western tradition, there is quite a history of conflating technological superiority with moral superiority or superior intelligence. But I would say that science recently has offered us a way out. Jared Diamond has synthesized a great deal of new work. He has explained the significance of recent improved radiocarbon dating of seeds, of the ancient remnants of plant seeds. Historians and anthropologists have long known that advanced civilizations, civilizations with writing and calendars, exist in association with agriculture because agricultural societies are sedentary and they have food surpluses and eventually greater populations. They divide labor and come up with inventions. But the long hovering question then has been, why did some people become farmers so much earlier than other people? And that was the question we were all afraid to ask for fear the answer is some people were smarter than others. But the new radiocarbon dating techniques of the seeds have told us that, in fact, people were becoming farmers in ancient times wherever there existed a constellation of protein-rich plants. So in the Middle East, where you had wheat and barley and oats, and you just had to throw some of that into the ground and wait till next year, and you'd have plenty of protein to feed your children, people did become farmers. On the other hand, in parts of the world where your best crops were, say, sugar or bananas, it wasn't worth your time to become a farmer on a full-time basis anyway, so people didn't. And even in the New World, where you did have corn, it wasn't protein-rich enough to live on, at least not at first. It took thousands of years of part-time, sort of hobby-like farming to turn the tiny little kernels of wild corn into something that people could live on. Once they had done that, they did become full-time farmers, first in Mexico and then through long-distance trade. That corn spread northwards to Pocahontas's people. But they had only had it for 300 years when the English came, so they had only been sedentary or even partly sedentary for 300 years. The English, on the other hand, were the inheritors of a cultural tradition that had been sedentary for 11,000 years, essentially. So they had the ships, they had the gunpowder, they had the writing system, the books that told each other where they had been before, the armor to prevent the Indians' arrows from hitting them, everything on their side.
Interesting. Good connection with Jared Diamond. So what do we know about Pocahontas in her life before the English got to Jamestown?
There are many ways one could answer that question. Theirs was a very rich tradition. The fact that they were semi-nomadic doesn't mean that they didn't have a complicated culture and history. But very specifically, I would say people need to know about the political history of her own and her father's tribe, because without that, it's much harder to understand what the English were facing. There was no monolithic state, if you will. Pocahontas' father governed over a coalition of tribes. He was what's called the paramount chief. He did not have full authority over them, but through a complex strategy of negotiation and use of force, he was able to add tribe after tribe until he had probably 20 to 30 groups under him. And intermarriage was a key part of that. He would convince other tribes to let a key noblewoman, a key woman from their chiefly line, have a child by him. And in some cases, he used force, okay, with the idea that that child, who had his mother's legitimacy, would then rule and would also be related to him and therefore, of course, help support his power. Pocahontas, however, was not the daughter of one of these important wives. She was the daughter of a throwaway wife, whether it was someone that he married for love or for other reasons. Okay? She was nobody important. So Pocahontas, in fact, was not a politically important figure at the start of her life. There is, in fact, no evidence that she was even the king's favorite daughter, as people are fond of saying. He specifically said in one of the sources that another girl was his favorite daughter, the daughter of an important princess. So we have a very complicated political situation full of separate tribes, each of which are out to defend their own interests. And then we have Pocahontas, a bright and wonderful girl, but in fact not someone who's politically important at the start of the story.
So when did the English first meet her?
Probably John Smith was the first to meet her when he was captured in December of 1607, when he was wandering up and down the Chickahominy River, trying to force the Indians, essentially, to give him corn that he could take back to the fort. He was captive in her father's village, and most likely she was there for about a month before the Indians brought him back to Jamestown. We know that they met her in May of 1608, the following spring, because in the constant skirmishing that occurred between the settlers and the Indians, several Indians had been taken hostage, and the father, Potin, sent his daughter with an elderly man, a man who was probably a royal advisor to the high chief, to the king, to try to negotiate their release. They probably sent her because her English was very good. She had been learning either from Smith when he was a prisoner there or from another young English boy that the English had deposited there so that he could learn the language. She translated very well, very eagerly for the elderly kinsman of Powhatan who came, and they did get the hostages released.
Okay, and that brings up, of course, the legendary story of John Smith's capture. And do you think it's true or not?
No, it almost certainly was not true. As I said, Smith was a captive there in Powhatan's village of Werowocomoco for about a month in the winter of 1607-08. But there is no evidence that they were ever going to behead him or brain him or that she threw her little 10-year-old body over his in order to protect him. In fact, when he, Smith, was released and then immediately wrote a report of his experiences and sent it back to England in 1608, he didn't mention anything like that. He said that they, quote-unquote, used me with what kindness they could. It was clear that they were interested in his being an intermediary. They had no interest in his being a dead body, which would be useless to them. The first time he told this story was in the 1620s when Pocahontas and her later English husband were dead and there was nobody to refute it. It was in a decade when he was busy running around writing several narratives and books, in each of which he claimed that a beautiful young woman had thrown her body across his in order to save him from some desperate fate. So I think that was a favorite theme of his, but not a story we necessarily need to take literally. Smith may well also in the 1620s when he made this up have been trying to explain to people that Pocahontas was supposedly different from all her people, because by then the Indians were in open rebellion, and he probably felt that it was important to underscore that she was the good Indian as opposed to the bad Indians.
By the time we get done, there's not going to be much left for Hollywood here. But you mentioned one of her husbands. Actually, according to your book, she married twice. She married a Native American, and then she married John Rolfe. Tell us a little bit about those marriages.
Yes. We don't know much about her first husband, the Indian husband. His name was Kokoum, and a very well-informed Englishman, someone whose word we can often trust. He turns out to be right very frequently. He claimed that this man, Kokoum, was a quote-unquote private captain, by which he meant an ordinary warrior, not the chief of a village. And that is almost certainly true because, as I said before, Pocahontas was no one important. Despite the fact that she was the daughter of a king, she held no political chiefly line within her person, if you will. So she would have been free to marry anyone. She didn't have to marry another chief. We don't know if they had any children, but probably not. they could have been divorced. That was very typical, very frequent in her culture. But most likely he was dead because Kokoam, again, we know was a warrior. And the skirmishing with the English and with other Western tribes continued all during this period. So she was then free to marry later in life and did marry an Englishman, as you know.
Now, when she married John Rolfe, she not only married him, but also became or declared herself a Christian and took on a new name, Rebecca. Why would she do this? Was she, in effect, did she realize that at least on the surface it looked like she was abandoning her identity and her people?
Yes, it does seem that way at first glance. And in fact, of course, the myth that has grown up around her is that she did abandon her people, if you will, in favor of the English and English ways. But in fact, the real story is much more complicated. The English had made a concerted effort to kidnap as many children of chiefs as possible, and she herself was kidnapped during the constant warfare. A lucky captain named Samuel Argall, when he was on the Potomac River, heard that she was visiting the chief of the Potomac Indians, so he lined his ship up against their village, aimed 7 guns straight at the village, and said, "You will give me this girl now." This was April 1613, several years after the events with John Smith. So she by now was a young woman. They did turn her over to the English. They had very little choice at that point. And she lived then with the English as their prisoner for a year. She was quite well treated. She lived in the home of a minister who was very eager to convert her, but she did not convert for a whole year despite the extraordinary pressures. Then in April of 1614, 1 year later, the English piled Pocahontas and a bunch of soldiers onto the same boat that had kidnapped her and went up the York River looking for her father. They were going to use her as a hostage, saying, "You must give us an annual tribute of corn. You must return all prisoners of wars. You must do X, Y, and Z, or your child will suffer. If you do these things, we'll return your child to you." She watched all of this, knew all this was happening, and then in the midst of this, John Rolfe, an Englishman who had been living near her in the home where she was imprisoned and may even have been her English teacher, suddenly proposed to the then governor of Virginia, Thomas Dale, that he marry her. Pocahontas received 2 brothers as emissaries from her father and sent the message back to her father, which must have been that she was willing to do this, because next thing you know, they get a message from Pocahontas saying, "Yes, we will end the war with you and do what you ask. In exchange, Pocahontas will marry John Rolfe." Within a week, she was baptized, and within a few days after that, married to John Rolfe. Now, these could be a series of coincidences, but if you ask me, it looks like she resisted pressure to convert for a year. Then, in the midst of this battle scene, essentially, in which these negotiations were taking place, agreed to convert. I think there is evidence that she probably did care very much about John Rolfe, though I don't mean to imply that she was miserable in the marriage. It would have been very typical, by the way, for a young woman in her culture to decide to marry with the enemy. Enemy-wise were a common phenomenon. It was a way of making peace, a well-known way of making peace. And in fact, it worked in this case for a few years. She had good reason to marry him, other than just throwing her people's ways out the window.
Well, interesting. Well, we only have a couple minutes left, so let me sort of wrap it up by asking you about what happened to Pocahontas and John Rolfe when they went off to England.
Well, she did a good job of doing what the Virginia Company wanted her to do, which was advertise the colony. She also seems to have done a pretty good job of what I surmise her father wanted her to do, which is gather information about the English, find out how many of them there were, what the situation really was. Unfortunately, she became overwhelmed there by the microbes that were foreign to her system and possibly by the entire situation. And she, who had resisted English germs in the past, succumbed and died in Gravesend before she even turned 21 years old. She did have a son who survived her, who was left behind in England to grow up, though John Rolfe went back to Virginia. And as soon as he was of age, 21 years old, he made a beeline across the Atlantic, went back to Virginia, and spent the rest of his days there. In fact, his descendants still exist in Virginia.
Okay. Well, it's not a bad ending, and that's where we're going to have to leave it. So thank you for joining us, and congratulations on a very fine book.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Camilla Townsend, professor of history at Colgate University and the author of Pocahontas and the Powhatan Dilemma, published by Hill and Wang. This is Talking History. Continuing on our theme of Native Americans, Kelly Shrum now joins us for our site of the week. She tells us about a virtual site where you can learn about the French and Indian raid on Deerfield, Massachusetts in 1704. Shrum is Assistant Director of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
On this website, you can hear the words of Reverend John Williams telling his version of the 1704 raid on Deerfield, Massachusetts. The enemy came in like a flood, and by their violent endeavors to break open doors and windows with axes and hatchets, awaked me out of sleep. This site documents the 1704 raid by 300 French and their Native American allies. During the raid, 112 Deerfield men, women, and children were captured and forced to walk 300 miles to Canada during winter. Two-thirds of the captives were later released and returned to Deerfield. The other third chose to remain with their captors. Visitors are introduced to the raid by an impressive multimedia exhibit describing the white settlement patterns that led to profound cross-cultural tensions. 10 short essays give historical background and context on the colonization of New England, as well as a summary of the various tensions between white settlers and Native Americans. Voices provides access to a 5-part audio commentary based on interviews with historians and descendants, 2 audio versions of Native American creation stories, and 3 17th century popular songs. The 5 cultures section includes brief overviews for each of the 5 groups involved: English, French, Mohawk, Huron, and Wabanaki. The 5 cultures are also represented in the 21 individual biographies historians and archaeologists have reconstructed of Native Americans, French, and English settlers. The site offers a dozen maps, including Native American territories and interactive maps of the raid and the march to Canada. After viewing and reading the evidence, visitors are asked to decide whether the raid was an isolated incident or part of a larger pattern of cross-cultural violence. To locate this site, visit historymatters.gmu.edu, type 1704 into the keyword search.
And finally, we conclude this week's show by providing some history behind an item in the news. Our guest commentator is Nancy Unger, professor of history at Santa Clara University, and she answers the question raised by the reaction to Jack Abramoff's guilty plea to charges of bribing public officials. Can any good really come out of congressional efforts to thwart corruption?
Will lobbyist Jack Abramoff's guilty plea to charges of bribing public officials, tax evasion, and fraud succeed in getting Congress to rein in lobbyists? Can any good really come out of congressional efforts to thwart corruption? The cynics say no. Yet democratic reforms have come out of past scandals. In the Gilded Age, the period of rapid industrialization and urbanization after the Civil War, political machines ruled the nation's small towns and big cities. From local offices right up through the presidency, corruption included backroom deals that routinely determined the nomination of candidates, making a colossal travesty of representative government. What ultimately changed things was public outrage, a stubborn refusal to cynically accept corrupt politics as business as usual. Then, as now, a few particularly egregious violations fueled the public's denunciation of wholesale bribery and corruption. One of the first was the 1872 Credit Mobilier scandal, in which high-ranking officials accepted bribes to ignore a scheme to launder money gained by swindling the government. Next came the Whiskey Ring. Federal politicians conspired with distillers to defraud the government of tax revenues on the sale of whiskey. The fallout included the resignation of President Grant's private secretary. The fact that 90% of Americans today want a ban on lobbyist gifts to lawmakers is promising. In the past, the outrage over flagrant violations of the principles of representative government disrupted the routine acceptance of corrupt practices. In Wisconsin, progressive great Robert La Follette fought for the direct primary, civil service reform, and restrictions on lobbyists. Public support swept La Follette and other progressives into the U.S. Senate, where they spread their anti-corruption agenda nationwide. Our having to face anew widespread political corruption suggests that previous legislation was ultimately ineffective. Such an argument, however, ignores the meaningful long-term progressive reforms that followed Gilded Age scandals. Two of the major accomplishments were the direct election of politicians, including senators, and civil service exams, ensuring that candidates be judged by the strength of their qualifications rather than by the size of their kickbacks. Past scandals prove that corruption, like hope, springs eternal. The good news here is not that there have been worse cases of corruption, but in the past, those periods gave birth to real change. The key is to keep the heat on Congress, to not allow loophole-ridden legislation to masquerade as meaningful democratic reform.
You've been listening to Nancy Unger, professor of history at Santa Clara University and the author of Fighting Bob La Follette, The Righteous Reformer. Unger's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beattie is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.